Welcome to the Burt Cohen Show. The dream of America, freedom, peace, justice, things like that. That's America, what it's supposed to be. Well, what has it become and what will it be? As everybody knows by now, John Paul Stevens is retiring from the 9-member, incredibly powerful United States Supreme Court. Whenever a president gets to appoint a new Supreme Court justice, it's a really big deal. In fact, people don't often vote on the subject, but they should, because Supreme Court justices last a lot longer than the president who appoints him or her. We have a number of people on the Supreme Court. Many of us wish really, really weren't there. And this Roberts Court is something else entirely. Well, with the retiring of John Paul Stevens, what happens next? Are they going to come back to sanity? What kind of appointment will Obama make? Will he have the courage to appoint somebody actually liberal or what? Well, our guest today on the Burt Cohen Show is David Gespass, president of the National Lawyers Guild, which was founded in 1937 and is the oldest and largest public interest human rights bar organization in the United States, headquarters in New York and chapters in every state. David, thanks very much for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, John Paul Stevens is retiring, and he's almost always labeled a liberal, but he was appointed by Gerald Ford to replace a liberal, William O. Douglas, back in 1975. He started out as a moderate, and it seems that he stayed put, but the court moved way to the right. Who is John Paul Stevens, and when was the last time there was an actual liberal on the court?
Justice Stevens, as you say, was appointed by Gerald Ford, and from our perspective at least, he was certainly a principled, conscientious jurist, but he was, even by his own definition and by any standards from at least my generation of the Supreme Court, when I grew up during the Warren years, was no liberal by any stretch of the imagination. I would say that the last true progressive Supreme Court justice was Thurgood Marshall, who retired a number of years ago and was replaced by Clarence Thomas. He was one of the only justices, perhaps the only one on the court when he retired, who had, for example, ever actually represented somebody on death row or being accused of capital crime, who had spent his time representing poor citizens rather than corporations. And that was reflected in the way he approached the law. It was reflected in the way he made his rulings.
John Paul Stevens, in what ways was he not a liberal? The one case that I'm aware of was the whole flag-burning issue, when I don't even know what a liberal versus conservative approach would be. But it seemed to me that to be consistent with the Bill of Rights, of course, offensive speech and what could be, you know, that's pretty offensive, burning a flag. I would think a person has a clear right to use that, and that the Constitution exists to protect such offensive speech. But where was Stevens on that, and why?
Well, and that would have been my first choice for an example. Stevens was served in World War II, and apparently felt very strongly about the flag in such a way that he ruled that burning the flag was not a manifestation of free speech. Interestingly, in that case, Justice Scalia ruled in favor of Joey Johnson, I think was his name, who had burned the flag, and Scalia believed that that was, in fact, a manifestation of freedom of speech that needed to be protected. Stevens did not feel that way, and again, my feeling is that that was, from his perspective, it was an honest belief, but the impact of the act of burning a flag, from our perspective, is so significant, and just by virtue of the fact that so many people find it offensive, it really is something that ought to be looked at as speech, because talking about the flag just doesn't have the same impact.
Yeah, that's certainly true, and as we all know, the Bill of Rights is there to protect not safe speech, but offensive speech. That's the whole point of it, really. And
Yes, and incidentally, political speech as opposed to commercial speech, which the Supreme Court these days seems much more concerned with defending.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, before we get on to what some of the issues are, again, John Paul Stevens is retiring. He's widely perceived, right or wrong, and I guess perception becomes reality after a time, widely perceived to be kind of a liberal or progressive. But who really has John Paul Stevens been? And should Obama appoint somebody like him in the same vein, or try to really go to the left?
Well, you know, Stevens himself has said that every justice, with the possible exception of Justice Ginsburg, every justice that has been appointed since he was appointed was more conservative than the one who was being replaced. And Stevens identifies himself as being quite conservative and says that he has not changed very much over the years. It may be that he has changed some, but it's really not just the court itself, but the political discourse in the country that has changed. The court is perhaps the most obvious example of how much the center has moved to the right over the last, say, two generations. When I was in law school, we had justices like Brennan and Marshall, Hugo Black, and Stevens would have been considered on that court on the right side, not a radical right, but on the more conservative side of that court, and would have probably been the minority in most issues involving the political questions that confront the court.
I actually, you're reminding me that back in 1964, yes, I remember that, when Barry Goldwater was considered extreme right. Well, by today's standards, I think he'd be considered a moderate or even a liberal, really, just, you know, as an example of how far the mood of the country in many ways has moved to the right. Certainly the media, and, you know, there is the so-called news from Fox Network, you know, which is really a propaganda arm of the hard right and the Republicans. And I can't help but think that it would be extremely hard for President Obama to choose somebody who would be, you know, more of a centrist in the more traditional mold, given the likely firestorm. I mean, they're just frothing at the mouth, ready to jump on whomever Obama picks. How likely is it that Obama might have the political courage and find somebody who could be you know, so unimpeachable that he or she could be a progressive and be on the court?
I find it totally unlikely. You know, I would say this, first of all, that regardless of who he appoints, that person is going to be decried as a radical, a socialist, judicial activists. And from the point of view of the Lawyers Guild, if that's going to happen anyway, he may as well, you know, appoint somebody like that and actually engage in the struggle. I don't anticipate that that's going to happen. And our view in the Guild now is that given that with Stephen's retirement, that it is really critical that we start to talk about who genuine progressives are, and we change the discourse in the country. For so long now, it has been dominated in terms of the judiciary by the Federalist Society, in such a way that these things that people are deemed to be left-wing or liberal who just don't even come close to actually being so, just by virtue of the way in which the conversation is carried out now.
Right.
And we don't see that this appointment is going to change that very much, but we think it important that we start engaging in that discussion, and we start talking about what a true vision of a Supreme Court that recognizes individual liberties, that defends the rights of poor and working class and oppressed people as opposed to the rich and transnational corporations. And frankly, that's historically has not been what the Supreme Court has done. The Warren Court was something of an aberration. If you look at the general history of the court, it has been generally probably the most reactionary branch of government. That has not always been the case, and there's no reason why it has to remain the case now. But that requires that we actually start talking not in terms of what we'd be willing to settle for in a justice, but really in terms of the kind of justice that we want on the court.
We are talking on the Burt Cohen Show with David Gespass, president of the National Lawyers Guild, and I really appreciate your time. I whenever I talk to lawyers, I sort of picture a meter going, you know? What can I tell you?
So that was the old John Stewart line when the Pakistani lawyers were in the streets and and demonstrating, and I'll just sort of mention that the Guild sent a delegation to Pakistan I was privileged to be a part of, and did some real work and lobbying after we came back in support of the lawyers movement there.
Yeah.
But John Stewart sort of mentioned that all the lawyers who came out and demonstrated in the United States in support of the Pakistani lawyers did so until they realized that there was no one to bill for their time.
Well, yeah. I don't know why everybody picks on lawyers. Some of my best friends are lawyers.
I appreciate that.
And, of course, I used to work in a law factory up in the state Senate in New Hampshire. We'd grind out the laws like sausages. But anyway, why is it so important to have a progressive? I mean, you know, not just for oppressed people and poor people, but for what's left of the middle class. Why should our listeners, our average listeners, care? How was their life affected? And why is it so important for them to have a more progressive, shall we say, member of the U.S. Supreme Court?
I think the court is more and more impacting people's lives these days. And when you get right down to it, it's not like, you know, the the bulk of the opinions and decisions the Supreme Court makes are those momentous decisions that have this long, this huge impact. But in fact, those are the ones that are important, and they happen with increasing frequency. I think the most recent and clearest example is the Citizens United decision, where the court has now imbued corporations with all the attributes of living, breathing human beings, and says that they have unencumbered free speech.
Yeah, that is amazing. That's it's sort of hard to even talk about that because it could be so powerful. But being a lawyer, someone who gets paid to talk, how could you explain the impact of that Citizens United case that people might really see in, say, for example, in the upcoming election?
Yeah, well, I'll do my best. The essential ruling of the case is that free speech rights, we always used to think that the Bill of Rights pertained to human beings. The Supreme Court has said now that it pertains to corporations. And that involves what I think are a lot of sort of myths about what corporations are and are not. What happens, and this frankly applies when you're talking about big corporations, the transnationals, or, you know, some small family-owned corporation, whether the people spend their own money or the corporate money is not that big a deal. But there's this sort of, what I refer to as the fetishism of the corporation, in which a corporation is imbued with these attributes of life and ability to function. And what is obscured by that is the fact that the corporations only act through the people that control them. And what really happens here, and what is going to happen, I think, is that the large shareholders who actually control corporations are now able to parlay the wealth of the corporation, which includes a lot of small investors, people who have mutual funds, people who, you know, bought a few shares of stock here and there, people with 401ks, and they have put that money in stock for corporations in hopes that they're going to have it when they retire or whatever. But that wealth is now going to be used by the people who control the corporation, and it's not a majority, they don't own a majority of the shares, but they own enough to control it, to advocate for their political views. So, in fact, what happens is the wealthiest people in the country, who already have disproportionate political power by virtue of their wealth, are now able to use the wealth that is contributed to the corporation by small investors, by middle-class people, by working people, and use it to advance their own political agenda. And that is not necessarily going to reflect the views of the majority of shareholders, but two, is certainly going to also reflect views that are to the disadvantage of those small shareholders,
and they could really buy elections. I mean, we've seen cases where individuals who have a tremendous amount of wealth, former Senator Corzine being an example, buying an election. He happened to be fairly liberal, pretty liberal actually. But now with this ruling, it really, a lot of people say it's really threatening democracy, government of, by, and for the people, as opposed to a plutocracy, which is government of, by, and for the very rich. And go ahead. I'm concerned about that.
Absolutely. I was just about to agree. I mentioned a couple of things in that regard, too, is I have I've observed elections around the world, and mostly in the former Soviet Union, and the standards that are applied to those elections by the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, by American observers, are directly contrary to the standards that we apply in the United States.
Amazing.
Yeah, you know, the right to use unlimited funds for campaigning is extremely limited. Much of the funding is provided by the governments, so that candidates use equal amounts. People are restricted from campaigning late in the last couple of days before the election to reduce the possibility of undue influence at that point. And what we have here, before Citizens United, we have the elections that are so enormously influenced and driven by finances.
Yeah.
We know that every member of Congress spends most of his or her time
raising money,
trying to raise money for the next election.
That's right.
And if that is now being parlayed by corporate power, that becomes even more egregious and even more pervasive.
Well, David, Senate Minority Whip John Kyle, Republican of Arizona, was on the Senate floor just a few days ago to warn President Obama that if he uses the campaign finance ruling, the Citizens United case, as a litmus test in selecting a nominee for the high court, that he, in that case, would face serious Republican opposition. And, of course, during the State of the Union address, Obama looked straight at the court, looked straight at the Roberts Court, and criticized that court's, those nine people's, ruling on the Citizens United case, Justice Roberts. I hate to say those two words together, Justice Roberts, called Obama's comments very troubling. Now, here's Kyle saying, if you make that a litmus test, we're going to put up a fight. Seems to me they're going to put up a fight no matter what.
I think that's absolutely the case. I think that they did, with the last, with Judge Sotomayor, who was, was by no means a left wing jurist. Her history was being in the prosecutor's office and being a corporate lawyer. Again, there's really sort of no point, I don't think, for Obama not to appoint somebody who's at least, reasonably progressive. I have no great hopes. Just because whoever he appoints is going to be vilified.
Yeah.
I go back actually to, John Kerry's campaign for president when he was, just sort of moderated all his positions.
Yeah.
And said, "Oh, I never really said that there were war crimes committed in Vietnam and whatever." And kind of my feeling is, if you're going to lose, you may as well lose standing for something.
And I would hope that Obama would have learned that lesson, because in the recently completed healthcare reform struggle, it appeared to me that the president went in compromising. He started out compromising. And what did that get him? Nothing. Bupkis, not a thing. So why not, as you say, go in fighting? And there's a good quote from Tom Harkin, one of my favorite U.S. senators, Democrat from Iowa. He said, "I think we need to push someone who would be on the liberal side, on the progressive side, just as Roberts and Alito are on that side. Why do conservatives always get the conservatives, but we don't get the liberals? What the hell is all that about?"
Mm-hmm.
The fuss that was not made over Roberts and Alito, I couldn't believe it. I don't understand. Maybe you have some analysis of why the Democrats basically rolled over and played dead with these extreme right-wingers. I mean, very far out, I'd say unique, well, maybe not unique, but a very different interpretation of the Constitution from my interpretation of the Constitution. The Democrats did nothing. What do you make of the politics there? Why is what Harkin said so accurate? They get what they want. We don't get what we want.
I remember in I was at this conference in after the 2000 election. It was some sort of pro-democracy conference, and one of the people there was saying she wanted to start an organization called Backbones for Democrats.
Really?
I mean, I do not understand. I mean, well, I'll say this, that there has been, I think, over the years, the right wing, which is putting it kind of the reactionaries in this country, have developed really... developed strategy and tactics around how they were going to change the discourse and how they were going to promote their views and their ideas and their politics.
Framing it, yeah.
And I think what progressives need to do is learn some of those lessons and come up with a strategy. What we see, I think, too much on the left is just tactics kind of as a process. You go from one issue to another and come up with the tactics you think are going to get the best possible result you can hope for at this point. Without a strategy on how you're going to move everything forward. I'll tell you, I remember when I was in high school, William F. Buckley ran for mayor of New York. And I will never forget that. He was very, very charming. He gets in and talks about how he was like, all the other candidates were the same, and he was different because he was a real conservative. And he was asked if he got elected, what would be the first thing he did. He said, I'd demand a recount, not that many years later, it was a while, but his brother got elected senator.
That's right.
And I think that for people who actually are concerned with the day-to-day welfare of the people in this country who are who have the least, it is a more difficult strategy to develop than for Bill Buckley, who had his views in mind and started his magazine and whatnot, and really didn't care about anybody suffering in the interim. But for those of us who really care about people who are hungry, people who are homeless, people who don't have health care, I think the calculus becomes a lot more difficult because you don't want to sacrifice some advantages that people can develop quickly for a long-term change in society that is really going to make a difference for them. But nevertheless, those are strategies that we really have to talk about, that we really have to develop. And that's why the Guild, has initiated with this nomination, this determination that no longer are we going to settle. At least somebody is going to say, just because this appointment is not as terrible as some of the others, it doesn't make it good. And we're going to be, we want from now, and not just each time there's a vacancy, we want to be talking and engaging in this discussion about what we really need to see in a justice. And I think that same discussion needs to take place throughout, around all issues of society and the welfare of our people, and not just that of judicial appointment.
We are talking on the Burt Cohen Show with David Gispass, president of the National Lawyers Guild, about the sudden vacancy on the Supreme Court. Actually, there may be a vacancy over at the Vatican fairly soon, too, but we're not talking about that. But we hear often about the phrase judicial activism. People on the right are always screaming about, well, lots of things, but including judicial activism, legislating from the bench. Can you talk about your definition of judicial activism and just how charged that phrase is?
Yeah, it seems to me that judicial activism is generally making decisions, a judge making decisions that you particularly don't like. As far as I can tell, I mean, there is the role depends, I think, on your view of what the role of a justice is. And I think we see it rarely because it is a difficult thing for judges to do, actually, especially a lot of state court judges who have to run for re-election and whatnot. But the most important thing for a judge is to be able to say, when the majority of the people believe one thing, to say, no, you can't do that because we have certain fundamental liberties here that cannot be abandoned.
Mm-hmm.
That's the difference between liberal democracy, which is a democratic form that protects basic individual liberties, and say the democracy that existed under Fujimori in Peru, when he had the support of a large majority of the people to carry out, in fact, terror.
Yeah.
Against certain elements of the population.
Right.
And that is the most noble role, I think, of the judiciary, is to ensure that those transgressions don't take place.
Right. I would think that is one of the most important things. It's not about enforcing the will of the majority on the minority in our, as you say, liberal democratic system. It should be about protecting the rights of the minority from imposition of the will of majority in protecting the Constitution. It seems to me the Constitution is an amazing document that was just a tremendous gift for us for, you know, quite a few hundred years to go, hopefully. And if we have a system that you know, the court is in service to the most powerful, the government is in the service of the most powerful, that's not the America I grew up in, and that's not what I would call conservatism. It's a kind of a scary situation. Would you say that the, you know, in terms of, you know, an activist court is, you know, somebody with whom you disagree, but the Roberts Court, many have said that has been one of the most judicially activist courts in history. Your comments on that?
I think it's fair to say that they have been one decision after another that has changed dramatically the legal and political landscape. Aside from Citizens United. There's remarkable decisions around, you know, so-called states' rights, which says that actually a little bit before Roberts, but that where the court held that the federal law that prohibited carrying guns within a certain distance from public schools was unconstitutional because only the states could regulate that, which was in marked contrast to their decision that even if states decided that some use of marijuana for medical purposes, whatever, was lawful, that the federal laws prohibiting sale and possession of marijuana were in fact constitutional. I think that, the act, it depends on, again, on I think right. a little bit on how you define what is and what isn't activism. I was always brought up, and when I was a kid and learning about the courts and learning about the Constitution, what I was always taught was that the Constitution is a living document.
Yes.
Justice Scalia refers to it not as a living document, but as an enduring one. And what that means from his point of view intellectually, I suppose, is that he has to look back and decide exactly what the framers meant when they said, when they used some phrase such as, privileges and immunities, or due process, which are pretty elastic phrases. And, and I think part of what we often forget is that the people who drafted the Constitution, formed this country, were engaged in some pretty vicious political debates. And no one necessarily agreed on everything, all the words, on the meaning of the words of the Constitution. So going back to what the framers intended when they said something is almost impossible, because it depends on which framer you're talking about as to what was intended.
Right. But the document, we do have the First Amendment, which is, the Bill of Rights, which is pretty clear. Of course, the Second Amendment is open for debate quite a bit. and the debates do go on. Let's talk perhaps about some of the current names that are out there. I mean, these could all be just brushed aside by next week. But we have Solicitor General Elena Kagan, Federal Appeals Judges Diane Wood and Merrick Garland. What do you know about these people? Should people who care about, valuing traditional individual liberties be comfortable with these people?
Certainly Elena Kagan we have real concerns about.
Why is that?
She has, she is, prior to being Solicitor General, when she was required to, represent the United States, she has certainly written articles that kind of expand the definition of terrorism to things that I would at least consider to be protected speech. She has talked about limiting the rights of accused terrorists, and she's talked about expanding executive power.
Ooh.
I think all of those things are really problematic.
Yeah, and I would say, people who, it's interesting, again, activism is how you want to phrase it, and what some people call a freedom fighter, other people call terrorists, and those people like me and others who speak out and criticize the government, perhaps under some, as you say, elastic phrase, could be called terrorists. And to have, our rights stripped away, people who were opposed to the war in Vietnam. I mean, that was a real, almost a war in the streets here. And, the people who were, there were people at some demonstrations holding flags of the National Liberation Front, also known as the Viet Cong. My guess is they could be called terrorists. And, whoa, what happens to our rights and liberties in that case?
Sure. And I would just note that there was a time when Nelson Mandela and the African National Congress. Well, the ANC was identified as a terrorist organization by this country. And Nelson Mandela, who I think is one of the great political leaders of the 20th century, if not the greatest, was branded a terrorist. So those things become really, of great, great concern. And, I may not be as much of an absolutist on free speech issues as the ACLU is, and I wouldn't be, I don't think they'd ask me, but I wouldn't represent the Nazi who was trying to exercise the right of free speech just as a personal choice. But I think we always have to err on the side of more speech rather than less.
Yes. Yes, I certainly would say so. And I can't help but think that at the time of the War of Secession from England, also known as the American Revolution, that the people who spoke out against England, if they had the word terrorist at the time, they would have used it.
Sure.
The founders of this nation. We are talking on The Bert Cohen Show with David Gispass of the National Lawyers Guild. Well, I mentioned Elena Kagan. You expressed some real concerns about her, but what about, I don't know if you're familiar with any of the others, Diane Wood, Merrick Garland? Supposedly they have the edge over the others being considered.
Yeah, I don't know that I would say I have strong feelings about them. I don't think either are the kind of justice that I would advocate for, at this stage.
Right.
The justices that we would want to see, the people that we've discussed, people like Brian Stevenson or Stephen Bright or Erwin Chemerinsky, who are really true progressives. Now, if it got down to Garner or Wood being nominated, that is something we actually are looking at now, and the Guild is trying to look a little bit more deeply into their histories and their writings, so that we can make some
recommendations,
considered statement about them. My inclination now is to say that they are qualified as jurists.
Well, that covers a lot of ground. There's a lot of people who are qualified.
Right, and our concern is, and my concern certainly is, that how is that going to impact the court as a whole? I read an op-ed piece this morning, an editorial this morning, that said, regardless of who is appointed, the court is going to be moving further to the right. Just because it's going to be, somebody new who does not have the authority and the connections that Stevens did, and that is going to mean that the reactionary wing of the court, as opposed to the right wing, there not being any left or center anymore, is going to be strengthened. Our ideal justice would be somebody who would provide a real forceful intellectual counterweight to the reactionary branch. And I don't see any of the names being on what is now seen as a short list as providing that. But, beyond that, it's not like I would be, at this point, deeply opposed to either one. But I don't know that we would be a...
Right, it wouldn't be the ideal.
A ringing endorsement from the National Lawyers Guild.
Right. They might not want that.
Right.
But, there's a lot of the senators who do tend to puff themselves up and, you know, they'll raise questions that they think will help them in November. You know, they're going to probably ask in the confirmation hearings questions about the constitutionality of the health care law, which, you know, it seems sort of superfluous, really, because I think it may be decided elsewhere. And I think it's pretty clearly constitutional. There's a heck of a lot of precedent for situations like that. Go ahead.
Let me just say, I mean, I think so as well. And I know most people look at it, and legal scholars say, this challenge is really, it just can't go anywhere. But nothing would surprise me with this court.
True.
Yikes. And I am just not that sanguine that and again with all of the shortcomings that I think this particular legislation has, it's about time that something was done, and I think we are better with it than without it.
Right.
Yeah. I just frankly would not come as a surprise to me if this court determined that this was an invasion of states' rights and would come up with some kind of rationalization to support that view. I'm not saying it's likely. I'm not saying it's going to happen. I'm just saying it wouldn't surprise me.
Well, we had the Supreme Court under Franklin Roosevelt saying that much of the New Deal was unconstitutional.
Exactly.
And he had that wonderful idea for adding a few members to the court.
Right.
Didn't work out real well. But,
well, you know, that's an interesting point, by the way, that I thought about a little bit. In some ways it did. Even though, and I think actually what it reflects is that however much justices are insulated from politics through lifetime appointment, they're not completely immune to the political pressures of the day. Because what happened was, not that long after the court packing scheme got sort of shot down, several justices retired. And Roosevelt was able to appoint some new ones, and, then some of that New Deal legislation actually started getting carried out.
Yeah.
So I think, sometimes I think that people underestimate exactly what the effect of the court packing idea was.
Interesting. Well, it did move. We did get the New Deal programs, and like it or not, the Tea Party people still get their Social Security checks and still get help from the Veterans Administration, still get Medicare. I don't know about this court. If they would, if those things were challenged, perhaps, if you go under the guise of states' rights, they could be challenged as well. And it's always said just before confirmation hearings begin, no litmus test, no litmus test. You don't want to say, for example, on the case of reproductive rights, Ben Nelson, one of the conservative Democrats, said, "I want to see someone who doesn't bring an ideology to the bench." But, there is precedent with regard to reproductive rights on Roe versus Wade, but it's quite possible. A lot of young women these days think, well, we have this right to an abortion and it's not threatened. Well, it seems to me it could be under this court. And it looks like there are a lot of cases now where, like, I guess Nebraska is passing something that if it's tested in the courts and goes to the Supreme Court, wow.
And, it's certainly been limited over the years. The most recent decision on so-called partial birth abortion was directly contrary to a decision the court had made just a couple of years earlier. So the direction that the reactionaries on the court are pursuing is clear, and the question is how far are they willing to go, and how far how far well how far are they willing to go, and how much they can be limited by the will of the people. That's why we think it's important to start changing the tenor of the public discourse.
Well, that leads to really the final topic here is that, you know, how is the public discourse framed? You have a lot of posturing right-wing senators, and there are 59 Democrats, allegedly. what can listeners do to help shape the discourse? Are we completely powerless? What can the average person do to help frame the debate and say, hey, you know, we really care about this? What can be done? Just contact your senator?
I suppose that's one thing that can be done. That is a very, very good question. I don't know, actually, whether that is something that can be accomplished by individuals, by themselves. I believe strongly in collective action, and I believe strongly that, you know, history is made by, not by individuals, but by people working together for
it works
in common struggle.
Absolutely.
And so what I think really needs to be done is that people, progressives, and that's also a term that different people will define differently,
right,
of course. But we have to spend less time fighting among ourselves about sort of specific points.
Right.
And more time engaged in the actual work of struggling to change society. Because
right.
I think the differences we have among ourselves are differences that are going to be resolved not through polemics, although there's a place for that, but they're going to be resolved by the actual experience of carrying out real work and engaging in real struggle. And that, I think, is what we ought to be spending much more of our time doing, is working towards those significant changes by participating in the actual work of effectuating them.
Yeah, actually getting involved in doing what works to make real change. There's got to be some way that people can make their voices heard and not have it just be dominated by the right wing. I've heard it said by, Abby Hoffman a long time ago said, the relationship between the right and left is perfect. The left is masochistic, the right is sadistic. It's perfect. And the right seems to stick together on these important things and put aside their differences, but the left...
And those differences are not insignificant.
No.
there are a lot of those differences. You know, at different times, the differences are going to be more pronounced from one side or the other. But the critical thing, I think, is that we really engage, not think in terms of, that our engagement is every November or every 4 years at the ballot box, but engaging in politics is something that we do on a daily basis. In the course of really fighting for a decent society.
It's called citizenship. David Getzpass, president of the National Lawyers Guild. The website is www.nlg.org, I believe.
That's correct.
Thank you so much for being with us on the Burt Cohen Show.
Enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
Well, let's hope we can protect our traditional rights. Thank you so much.
Let's even try to expand those rights a little bit.
Whoa, you are an optimist. Thank you so much for being with us. And I welcome your input. Email me, Burt@theburtcohenshow.com, BURT@theburtcohenshow.com. And we've been talking about the Supreme Court. So let's hear a little something from the Supremes.
I need love, love to ease my mind. I need to find someone to call mine. But mama said you can't hurry love, no, you just have to wait. She said love don't come easy, it's a game of give and take. You can't hurry love, no, you just have to wait. You gotta trust, give it time, no matter. Don't come.